Well, in 1985, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers famously sang, "Don't come around here no more. Don't come around here no more. Whatever you're looking for, hey, don't come around here no more." Now, I'm not exactly sure who Tom Petty was singing to, but it's clear that Mr. Petty was singing to another. He was warning a fellow human being to stay away, to avoid coming around anymore. Maybe you had a neighbor like that. Maybe an old guy. You know, get your ball out of my yard and that kind of thing. Perhaps that was your early childhood experience. And it's doubtless that we've had similar experiences in our own lives. It seems certain there have been times when we have warned others to stay away from us. Or we said, I don't want you around anymore. You can't come around me. You've hurt me too much, or you've done this thing to me. If you've had a sibling, you've told them, get out of my room. And they've told you, we share this room. Get out of my room anyway. Now, this staying away could be temporary. Sometimes, maybe if you're an introvert, you just need some time away from people. You've used up your words and you need a break. Are there some times where you tell someone to stay away and that's permanent? The person that's coming around is destructive. They're no good for you. And you say, I cannot have a relationship with you anymore. With that said, I believe that there are also times when we should tell ourselves, don't come around here no more. There are times when we should tell ourselves no, when we should hold ourselves accountable. Now, it could be something as minor as avoiding a certain store because we go there to spend too much money. Now, I've heard the jokes about Target. When you go to Target, you say, I'll see you $150 later. Whenever you go to Target, there's a lot of things to sell. And maybe a guy doesn't have that same problem, but I know for me, it's Academy. I go to Academy and there's like guns and knives and bullets and clothes and shoes and sporting equipment and weightlifting things, and there's just too much. So unless I have a gift card, I generally don't go there. Now, on the other hand, we may need to tell ourselves no to coming around, to not come around to something that's more serious. Maybe it's an abusive relationship that we need to end, or maybe it's a sinful activity that we're keeping hidden, or maybe it's this deep bitterness that we're nursing day after day. Whatever the case may be, we would do well to take inventory of our lives and then be willing to tell ourselves not to come around those sinful things anymore. And this brings us to the subject of the passage that we'll be studying this morning, because here in Genesis chapter 14, Abram's nephew Lot, he gets a wake-up call from the Lord. He gets an opportunity to tell himself to don't come around here no more regarding the sinful city of Sodom. But unfortunately, Lot refuses to make a change, and eventually he will suffer the negative consequences of that decision. Now, we'll be moving through the entire chapter of Genesis 14 this morning, so I don't want to read the verses up front, but if you're taking notes, I've divided this passage into three sections. We'll see, first of all, strained relations, then search and rescue, and finally, strange rendezvous. So let's move into our first section, that strained relations that we find in verses 1 through 11. Moses writes, "And it came to pass in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of nations." Now, this is one of those chapters that has a lot of interesting Old Testament names. I was just talking to my mom on the phone yesterday, and she'd been studying the Bible on her own, and she was asking, how do you pronounce Sennacherib? You know, from the book of Isaiah. And I said, I don't know. Just say it with confidence. That's what I teach my kids at school when I teach Old Testament. I say, you come to an Old Testament name, say it with confidence. People don't know any different. And so right off the bat here in Genesis 14:1, we're introduced to these unusual names and these four kings from Mesopotamia. The first king is Amraphel, king of Shinar. Now, you may remember that we first heard of Shinar back in Genesis chapter 10. So if you would, hold your place there in Genesis 14 and turn back to Genesis 10 for a minute. Genesis 10, looking at verses 8 through 10. We read, "Cush begot Nimrod, and he began to be a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord, therefore it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, Calneh, in the land of Shinar." Now, because Nimrod and Babel are important to the overall story of the Bible, it's worth doing a little review. If you want the full thing, you can go back and listen to the Genesis 10 teaching on this. But I just want to talk for just a minute because of this Shinar that we see in Genesis 14. You see, Nimrod is the first individual in all of Scripture to whom a kingdom is attributed. He is the first king of the Bible. Now, Nimrod's empire was founded at Babel, there in the land of Shinar. And Babel is the same word translated Babylon that we see throughout the Old Testament, and in fact, that we see even into the book of Revelation. Now, after the dispersion of the nations recorded in Genesis 11, Babylon became this great ruling city over the destinies of men. And by the time of Nebuchadnezzar, that we read about in the book of Daniel, the city of Babylon amazingly covered an area of 225 square miles. 225 square miles, or about a quarter the size of Houston. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. I don't know how big Houston really is, but it seems bigger. Now, notice in Genesis 10:10 that we also read of Nimrod's conquests by the name of Erech, Akkad, and Calneh, three cities in the area. One was south of Babylon, one north of Babylon, and one northeast of Babylon. And it says that those cities in Babylon enabled Nimrod to control this area that was called Shinar, this entire land. Now, as we turn back now to Genesis 14, it's true that we do not know much about Amraphel, king of Shinar. We don't know the progression after Nimrod, but it does seem clear that he ruled over the same area that had previously been conquered by Nimrod. And as we move through this chapter, we see that he seems to be a similar type of guy. Now, the second king of Genesis 14:1 is Arioch, king of Ellasar. Now, scholars are unable to conclusively identify this king or the area of Ellasar. The third king is Chedorlaomer, king of Elam. Now, Genesis 10:22 tells us that the sons of Shem were Elam, Asher, Arphaxad, Lud, and Aram. So this Chedorlaomer, he's this king over this area that was the first of Shem's sons. The first of Shem's sons was Elam, and so this area was named after him, and this guy Chedorlaomer becomes king over that area. And it's this mountainous district east of Babylon. So as we put the pieces together, it would seem that to indicate that Amraphel and Chedorlaomer, they're these neighboring kings, that they're kings over areas that butt up to one another. And as we move through Genesis 14, it seems clear that Chedorlaomer was the head of the four-king coalition. It's also interesting to note that the first part of Chedorlaomer's name is a common element in Elamite royal names, that he was named this because he's royalty. The fourth king is Title King of Nations, which I just think is the coolest of all of them. Title King of Nations. But like Arioch, King of Ellasar, nothing conclusive has been determined about this guy. We don't really know who he was exactly or the extent of his rulership. Let's move on now to verse 2. It says that they made war with Bera, King of Sodom, Bersha, King of Gomorrah, Shinab, King of Admah, Shemeber, King of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar. So what we have here is a battle royale. We have on the one side these four kings, and then we have on the other side these five kings. These four kings that we mentioned in verse 1, they're all from Mesopotamia, and they're coming south against these five kings that are all have their kingdoms in the Dead Sea area. Now, when we think about these kingdoms, it seems that these four kings from verse 1 roll over a larger area, where these smaller kings of verse 2, actually, they're more kings over cities. So it's not kind of like King Arthur or those kind of things. It's more like these city-states, these smaller areas that they're kings over. So it's Amraphel, Arioch, Chedorlaomer, and Tidal. They're the four marching south against Bera, Bersha, Shinab, Shemeber, and the king of Bela. We don't know much about these five kings of Genesis 14:2, other than the fact that they all had kingdoms in the area of the Dead Sea. And it would be helpful on your own to kind of just familiarize yourself with what Israel looks like and kind of some of the landmarks with the Sea of Galilee and the River Jordan and the Dead Sea. Just it makes it easier for you to visualize what's going on here. Verse 3, all these joined together in the Valley of Siddim, that is the Salt Sea. So the Valley of Siddim near the Dead Sea became the scene of the battle of the nine kings and their armies. So this valley, it's interesting, as I was doing some research into it, it's believed to actually be currently underwater. that the Dead Sea has expanded its boundaries over time, and that this area where this fight took place is believed now to be in the southern bay of what is the modern Dead Sea. So you'll see there in verse 3 where it says the Salt Sea, that's the same thing as the Dead Sea. We would call it the Dead Sea. On a side note, the waters of the Dead Sea contain approximately 5 times greater concentration of chloride and bromide salts than the waters of in the world's oceans, and so it makes it the making it the densest large body of water on Earth. And I've watched videos of people just going out there and then just floating because there's so much salt content, it's so easy to float there. Now, moving into the next verse, we learn why this battle was happening in the first place. Verse 4, 12 years they served Chedorlaomer, and in the 13th year they rebelled. So we need a little historical background to figure out what's going on. And so what we need to realize is that this raiding, conquering, and making other kings and city-states subservient vassals were part of how things were done in the Fertile Crescent during Abraham's day. And in fact, in many areas where there's not a strong government, this still goes on today. Where there's these certain individuals and say, hey, well, we're stronger than those guys over there, so why don't we conquer them and then make them pay us for protection? That's just what was going on. So these kings would go out seeking to expand their kingdoms, and they would go prey on weaker kingdoms. And they would do this for a number of reasons. Sometimes it was to open trade routes. Maybe they wanted to trade with other areas, and so they would conquer these different places along the way to make sure they had safe trade routes to increase their revenue. Sometimes it was to gain natural resources, especially in the ancient world where something like water would be at a premium. And so if I can conquer your area and get a source of water, then that's all the better for me. Or another times it's just for a stream of revenue. If I can conquer a people and tax them, then that way I can trade with more powerful countries because I have money now. So the subservient states would be called vassal states. And then the ones that were in power, their conquerors, would be suzerains. And so these vassal states would be required to pay tribute to their conquerors, suzerains. Now apparently what we have here are the 5 vassal states of Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, Zeboim, and Bela. They paid tribute to these 4 stronger states, to these 4 stronger kings, to Chedorlaomer and his allies for 12 years. So for 12 years, they're paying tribute, year after year after year. But then after 12 years, they decided, you know what? I really don't want to pay taxes anymore. Let's not do this anymore. Let's see what happens. And this is what would take place in the ancient world. These vassal states, if they thought they could throw off the yoke of their suzerain, if they thought they could not pay taxes and get away with it, not pay tribute and get away with it, then they would rebel. They would rebel not actively, but passively. In other words, they would just stop paying. They would stop paying the tribute, and then they would wait for a military response. They would wait to see if something happened. And as I was thinking through this, this is not at all dissimilar to our own American Revolution. You know, the American colonists, as England began to tax more and more and more, and then there began the cry of no taxation without representation. And so there was this battle going on and this desire to, you know what, I'm not going to pay taxes to you anymore. This is ridiculous. And there was a war that came out of that, the American Revolution. But as we'll see here, the kings of the Dead Sea did not fare quite as well as the American colonists. Verse 5, in the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him came and attacked. So, 13th year goes by, the southern kings don't pay, so year 14 rolls around, and the northern kings say, let's go get these guys. Let's teach them a lesson. So Chedorlaomer and his fellow kings, they lead their forces down into the Dead Sea area, and they're going to teach these rebellious vassals a lesson. Chedorlaomer and his allies, they also wreak havoc along the way. Notice in verse 5 that Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him came and attacked the Rephaim in Ashtaroth Karnaim. Now the Rephaim here, they're most likely one of the early tribal groups that inhabited Canaan when Abram entered the land. And as you put together the other biblical accounts, they're usually powerful warriors. And this Ashtaroth Karnaim was the capital of the region just east of the Sea of Galilee. And it's interesting, you can go online and just search, you know, Genesis 14 map, and you can kind of see the route that it's believed that these kings took and get some more information there. We also read that the forces of the four kings attacked the Zuzim in Ham, the Emim in Shava, Kirithaim, and the Horites in the mountain of Seir, as far as El Paran, which is by the wilderness. So the Zuzites, Emites, and Horites were the inhabitants of the Transjordan in the regions eventually occupied by the Ammonites, Moabites, and Edomites. So they lived there near the Jordan River. The Horites were commonly identified with the Hurrians, which were a non-Semitic people widely dispersed throughout the ancient Near East. You notice here also in verse 5 that we read Ham. Remember that Ham was one of the sons of Noah. So this area was named after one of the sons of Noah, was located in northern Gilead, and Shava Kirithaim was in Reubenite territory when the land was divided among the tribes after the conquest of the Promised Land under Joshua. Now, El Paran was probably Eleth at the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba. And again, there are maps online if you're more interested in this. Verse 7, then they turned back and came to En-Mishpat, that is, Kadesh. So they're going, they're conquering these areas along the way, and then they're turning back to go to this one area. And so this is the same place as Meribah Kadesh, where Moses famously misrepresented the Lord, as recorded in Numbers chapter 20. Same area. I want to read that for you. Numbers chapter 20, verses 10 through 13. We read, and Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock, and he said to them, hear now, you rebels, must we bring water for you out of this rock? Then Moses lifted his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod, and water came out abundantly. And the congregation and their animals drank. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, because you did not believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them. This was the water of Meribah, because the children of Israel contended with the Lord, and he was hallowed among them. So this same place where that happens in the book of Numbers. And it's a reminder to us that the Bible is always purporting to be real history that happens in real places on planet Earth. It's very important. There's many popular pastors out here who are really seeking to diminish the historicity of the Bible and say, oh, we don't have to believe it as real history. Just believe what it teaches on spiritual things. But my question is, if we can't trust it when it teaches historical things, how would we be able to trust it when it teaches spiritual things? And so real history, real geography, places, in fact, today, many of which have been discovered that you can go over to Israel and visit yourself. Now, continuing on in Genesis 14, verse 7, we read that the four kings attacked all the country of the Amalekites and also the Amorites who dwelt in Hazazon Tamar. These Amalekites were tribal people living in the Negev, remember the south, and in the Sinai Peninsula on the way to Egypt. The Amorites dwelt on both sides of the Jordan and in the mountains that afterward belonged to the tribe of Judah. Now, regarding the devastation caused by this Chedorlaomer-led campaign, famous archaeologist Nelson Gluck wrote the following, quote, I found that every village in their path had been plundered and left in ruins, and the countryside was laid waste. The population had been wiped out or led away into captivity. For hundreds of years after, the entire area was like an abandoned cemetery, hideously unkempt, with all its monuments shattered and strewn in pieces on the ground. So this archaeologist, who I believe that he died maybe in the 70s, in the 1970s, he was this guy who would search, and I believe he's credited with something like 1,500 different Bible sites that he discovered or excavated. And so he tracked this path that these kings took and basically said they just wrecked everything along the way. That's how they did things. And I believe it was to send a message to any other vassal state that wanted to rise up that these guys were not to be trifled with. Moving on to verse 8. And the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, the king of Zeboim, the king of Bela, that is Zoar, went out and joined together in battle in the valley of Siddim, against Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, Tidal, king of nations, Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar, four kings against five. And so the nine kings and their armies meet up to wage war. It almost sounds like something from The Hobbit. The Battle of the Nine Kings, or the Battle of the Nine Armies. Unfortunately, it's not that exciting. Verse 10, now the valley of Siddim was full of asphalt pits. Now, the word asphalt here could be translated tar or bitumen, maybe depending on your translation. But however you translate the word, it refers to a naturally occurring substance that consists mostly of hydrocarbons and was often used as a sealant. there in the ancient world. And it's something that's even used today, you know, to insulate roofing or to in parking lots. And so asphalt, though, it's interesting. If you go to the Dead Sea, you can see it floating on the surface of the Dead Sea. It just comes up and begins to float there in the Dead Sea or Salt Sea. Now, according to Genesis 14:10, notice there, the Valley of Siddim was full of asphalt pits. They were everywhere. And that's going to make it a little bit challenging when you're trying to run away and you're trying to avoid these asphalt pits as you go. Continuing on in verse 10, we read, "The kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled. Some fell there, and the remainder fled to the mountains." So we don't know how long this battle took, but it doesn't go well for the rebel vassals. They're soundly routed. And so the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah, they make a run for it. And some of their soldiers are killed on the battlefield. The rest of the rebel forces flee to the mountains. They just want to get away. But it gets worse. Verse 11, "Then they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their provisions and went their way." So the armies of the four kings loot Sodom and Gomorrah, having emphatically made their point, that then they turn around and head home. But that's not the end of the story, as we'll see in our next section. That's really just the prelude. So let's move now to search and rescue in verses 12 through 17. Verse 12, "They also took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed." So Chedorlaomer and his crew, they take Lot as one of their captives. And notice here that Lot now dwelt in Sodom. Look there in verse 12. "Abraham's brother's son who dwelt in Sodom." See, this is a new thing. This might seem subtle to you, but when we last saw Lot back in chapter 13, in verses 12 and 13, we read this: "Abram dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain and pitched his tent even as far as Sodom. But the men of Sodom were exceedingly wicked and sinful against the Lord." So what had happened is that, remember, there was a separation between Lot and Abram. The guys were, their keepers of the sheep were fighting together. And so they separated, and Lot saw, man, that looks good over there, the well-watered plain of the Jordan. And he went, and it says he pitched his tent as far as Sodom. But what's being said there is that he's kind of in the area. He's in the area, and we talked about last week about how that's a problem, and we're going to talk a little bit more about it in just a moment. But now we have a bigger problem, because Lot's not just in the area, he's actually living in the city. He's moved in the city, and now because he's moved in the city, now he's been taken captive. So this lets us know that Lot wasn't content with pitching his tent as far as Sodom. Instead, he chose to live in Sodom. And this is a huge mistake for two reasons that I mentioned last week that I want to go back over to remind ourselves of. Because it's not like the demonic forces take a week off. It's not like our flesh takes a week off. It says, hey, here's the deal, Steve. This week, I'm just going to leave you be. It's going to be peaceful. You're going to be fine. No, the sinful me is with me everywhere I go. And so I need to be reminded of these things. And what I want to mention again, number one, is you become like those you hang around with. It's inevitable. By Lot hanging out near Sodom, kind of, you know, rubbing elbows with them and then moving in, he began to be like them. Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 15:33, "Do not be deceived. Evil company corrupts good habits." Evil company corrupts good habits. It doesn't matter what kind of good habits you have. You hang around with ungodly people long enough and you allow them to influence you, that's what's going to happen. And we see this with Lot once we get to Genesis 19. He begins to act like the people of Sodom. Number two, when you hang around with evil people, expect your family to become victims of that evil. Lot's family was irreparably damaged by the influence of Sodom, by him taking his family there. And then we see a new reason here, a third reason that the move into Sodom was a bad idea. And that's this: when you hang out with evil people, you get caught up in their trouble. When you hang out with evil people, you get caught up in their trouble. You know, this happens to a lot of people in college. They're pretty good kid, but they have some friends that are troublemakers. And they go and hang out in a place where they're not supposed to be, and their friend has a big mouth and gets in a fight, and all of a sudden they're swept up in the fight. And then police are involved, and there's all kinds of stuff going on. That's just what's going to happen. When you hang out with troublemakers, expect for trouble to come. C.H. Spurgeon put it this way: "Those believers who conform to the world must expect to suffer for it. It's just going to happen. It's just going to happen. Now, as we think about Lot being taken captive by the four kings and then marched away into Sodom, you would hope that this would have been a wake-up call for Lot. You know, as I think about the story being played out, as Lot and his family are being taken, and they're kind of walking back to who knows where by Chedorlaomer and his crew, he could say, what am I doing in Sodom? Why did I come here? How did I get mixed up in this place? You would hope that you would have one of those prodigal son moments of like, man, didn't I have it better before? Weren't things different before? What if I go back and I just, you know, repent of what I've been doing? What if I just, you know, say, I want to do something different? Unfortunately, Lot did not have a change of heart. Afterwards, he would go straight back to Sodom after the situation was over. Proverbs 26:11 says, as a dog returns to his own vomit, so a fool repeats his folly. It's pretty gross. It's pretty gross, but I love the Bible just says, this is how it is. This is what it looks like. And we can be like that. We can make the same mistakes over and over again, not breaking free, not doing something different. Kind of like me continuing to trust in Aggie football. Every summer I tell myself, Steve, don't trust them. They're gonna break your heart. And then they do something like yesterday, try to give it away, win in overtime, and there's that little flicker of hope, only to be disappointed soon, I'm sure. And so the question for us really is, what is it in our lives that we need to break free from? What is it in our lives that we need to move away from? You see, Lot had an opportunity right here to say, if I get out of this situation, I'm going to do something differently. And maybe he even said that. You know, God, just let me pass this test. If you let me pass this test, I will always serve you. He could have said that. He could have said, Lord, if you let me out of here, everything will be okay. But he doesn't. So I would challenge all of us to think, man, has the Lord fired a shot across our bow? Has he fired a warning shot? Has he allowed us to get scraped a bit and say, you know what, maybe this isn't for you? And will we walk away from that thing that he's warning us about, or will we go back to it? Will we lie to ourselves that it's going to be okay? But you know, as the scriptures say, can a man take fire into his lap and not get burned? Can't we keep messing around with the wrong things? You know, whatever those things are, whatever our personal Sodom is, the scriptures command us this, to flee from those things and pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, and gentleness. That's what we're to pursue, because ultimately, whatever our Sodom is, that thing that we don't want to let go of, there's only death there. There's only death and judgment in Sodom. But true life is found in righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, gentleness. That's where life is. All right, let's move on in Genesis 14 to verse 13. Then one who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew, for he dwelt by the terebinth trees of Mamre the Amorite, brother of Eshcol, the brother of Aner, and they were allies with Abram. So a fugitive of the attack on Sodom found Abram and explained to him what had taken place. And so it seems that this guy knew Lot and he knew Abram. And as we're going to see in just a minute, Abram has quite the spread. Abram has quite a few people involved in his household. And so this guy would have been familiar with him. And so he goes and he tracks down Abram to let him know what's happened. And it's worth noting that this is the first time the term Hebrew is used in the scriptures. So we come across a lot of firsts here in the book of Genesis. And it notes this term Hebrew denotes that Abram is a descendant of Eber from the line of Shem. In the Bible, the term Hebrew, it's usually used by Gentiles when they describe the Jews. Now, we also see here in verse 13 that Abram had an alliance with three Amorites, Mamre, Eshcol, and Aner, or Aner. So these are three guys and their crew who were buddies with Abram, and it's likely that they had a defensive alliance, that they looked out for one another. They protected one another because it was a very uncertain world that they were living in. Verse 14, now when Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, this has confused a lot of people and say, well, it's calling him his brother here, but earlier it was the son of his brother. Well, brother here is being used in the generic term that means relative or countryman. And so it says that then Abram armed his 318 trained servants who were born in his house. Now that word trained there, it's the only place we find it in the Old Testament. And it's an interesting word. In other ancient documents, it's used for these like kind of trained guards, these bodyguards. So it seems that these were trained servants who were Abram's private militia, and likely they were highly skilled bodyguards and the protective force for his possessions. So pretty awesome. You know, if we had one bodyguard, that'd be kind of cool. 318. And so this, the fact that Abram has 318 trained militia as members of his household gives evidence that Abram was very, very, very rich. He was a wealthy man. Now think about that. Think about a company that employs 318 people. That's a sizable company. But this guy has Abram has 318 bodyguards, trained soldiers. And so Abram, his servants, and then the Amorite brothers and their servants, they all head out to rescue Lot. So they marshal this force together. And notice, and they went in pursuit as far as Dan. As I was looking at the maps, it seems that, you know, these forces that are carrying Lot, Chedorlaomer's forces that are going back up north, they're going on the eastern side of the Dead Sea, and it seems that and all of that area, and that Abram is going on the western side. And so Dan, it's a reference to the northernmost city of Israel. So what we have to understand here is that he's going a long way. Abram's going a long way. Estimates 150 miles to go track down Lot. Now, as we think about all the difficulty that Abram and the others went through to rescue Lot, I'd like to read what one Christian commentator wrote. Quote, "Backsliders bring not only misery on themselves, but trouble on others." It's true. Backsliders bring not only misery on themselves, but trouble on others. And there's a twofold application I want to bring out from this. Number one, if today you're in a backslidden state, then love others and get right with the Lord. Minimize the problems that you are causing to those who love you. That's the exhortation that I have for backslidden people. That's the exhortation I have for myself when I'm living in unrepentant sin. I'm unwilling to forgive, or I'm unwilling to do whatever. And I say, how is this affecting my family? How is this affecting the people around me? I need to do something different so I can treat them right. So that's if you're backslidden. But today, if you're a believer who's walking with the Lord, realize that seeking to restore backslidden believers is going to cost you. It's going to be costly. It's going to be tiring. It's going to be difficult, but I would exhort you, do it anyway. This is a great cost to Abram. He could have said, you know what? I'm tired of Lot. I'm tired of all his messes he gets into. I'm tired of him taking the best of the land. I'm tired of all this. But Abram chose to go after Lot. He chose at great personal cost to seek to restore him. Now moving on in Genesis 14 to verse 15, notice, he divided his forces against them by night, and he and his servants attacked them and pursued them as far as Phaba, which is north of Damascus. Now, it seems that this is not Abram's first rodeo. It seems that Abram has been involved in some skirmishes before, because he has some insight in how to do this thing. He travels a great distance, and then what does he do? He doesn't just kind of rush into it. He divides his forces into perhaps two groups, perhaps more, and then he waits to nightfall, and then he attacks. By waiting to nightfall, then the enemy forces don't really know how many people he has, and so just he has a tactical advantage here. And obviously, as we're going to see later, the Lord was helping him. Verse 16, so he brought back all the goods and also brought back his brother Lot and his goods, as well as the women and the people. So he has this great victory, not unlike Gideon's victory, where it was a small force against a much greater force, and the small force won. So Abram's completely successful, and at this moment, Lot has a chance to start over. Lot has a chance to say, ah, thanks, Uncle Abraham. Man, I was a fool to go back to Lot to go to Sodom. But unfortunately, he chooses not to do so. After the successful search and rescue mission, Lot goes right back to his own vomit. Let's move now from search and rescue to our final section, Strange Rendezvous, verses 17 through 24. Verse 17, and the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shava, that is the king's valley, after his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him. So as Abram makes his way back south after the resounding victory, the king of Sodom comes out of hiding to meet him. How convenient. Hey, I see you're coming back with my whole city. How are things? And so the valley of Shava here where he meets him, it's believed to be near Jerusalem, perhaps even referring to the Kidron Valley itself. And then as this meeting is about to happen, we don't know if it happened and then Abram turned his attention away from the king of Sodom to this new guy, or if he hadn't yet met up with the king of Sodom. But we have this interesting figure in verse 18. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of God Most High. Interesting. Now, for all the speculation regarding this man Melchizedek, I love the perspective that Pastor David Guzik gives. Quote, "We have no idea where Melchizedek came from, how he came to be in Canaan, how he came to be a worshiper and priest of the true God, and how Abram came to know about him. We only know he was there." Well said, David Guzik. And so there's a lot of debate on who Melchizedek is. Another Bible commentator writes this, quote, "The question cannot be settled completely. Otherwise, the identity of Melchizedek would have been agreed on by Bible scholars long ago." And so this is a really intriguing figure, and I want to give you kind of the three main choices people take when it comes to Melchizedek. Some say he's an angel. Some say that he's an angel that's been given this like position of authority there in the area. Maybe not. Some see him as the pre-incarnate Christ, that he is Christ appearing in form before he comes in the incarnation. And so there are actually some times throughout the Old Testament that I believe conclusively are the pre-incarnate Christ. I'm on the fence about this one. For Melchizedek here, I believe, is a type of Christ. I believe he's a mysterious figure, but not the pre-incarnate Christ. Now, we can have an arm wrestling match about it after service. It's one of those issues where if you believe he's an angel, a type of Christ, or pre-incarnate Christ, it's not a salvational issue. It's one of a debatable thing for us. But the reason why I don't believe that he is Christ himself is because when in the book of Hebrews, as you read about it, it says that that Jesus is a priest according to the order of Melchizedek. It doesn't say that he is Melchizedek. And so there's some things that are a little bit, I can't quite go there. But I know that people make strong arguments for all three of these, angel, type of Christ, or pre-incarnate Christ. And so I don't want to speculate about exactly who he is. I don't really know. I just want to focus simply on what the scripture says. But if you're more interested in it, if it's this kind of thing like, I really want to study this, I would encourage you to read Psalm 110 and then also read Hebrews 5 through 7. Psalm 110 and Hebrews 5 through 7 really talk a lot about that. Now, Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. Now, Melchizedek here, his name means either my king is righteousness or king of righteousness. And so we also read that Melchizedek was king of Salem, which would become Jerusalem. That was the ancient name for Jerusalem. And Salem means peace. So it's interesting, and this is what has led some to believe it's a pre-incarnate Christ, because his name is king of righteousness and he's also the king of peace. So that's kind of where they're going with that, and it could be. We're also told that Melchizedek came out to meet Abram with bread and wine, which immediately makes people think of the elements of the Last Supper, you know, that Jesus shared bread and wine with his disciples. But on the other hand, bread and wine were also the staples of the ancient world, especially of royalty. They're just things that would have been common, that is, you're having fellowship with one another, that you would share those things together. So we're also told in verse 18 that Melchizedek was the priest of God Most High. So Melchizedek was a king of Salem and a priest of the one true God. And what's so interesting about this is that in Israel, God did not allow any Israelite to be both a king and a priest. They were separate offices. You couldn't be both king and priest. And kind of this idea that that would be dangerous if one person held both of those offices. And so if this is the pre-incarnate Christ, well, then it would make sense that he would be this great high priest like we read about in the scriptures. But if he's not the pre-incarnate Christ, if he's just a follower of God, I think that's really interesting that God has this witness here, that this man who is following after the one true God that doesn't have any relation to Abram. Now, moving on to verse 19, we read, "And he blessed him and said, Blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." So interesting, Melchizedek is the first priest of the Bible. First one that we read about. He's the first priest of the Bible. And notice what he says. He says that the God Most High, or the highest of all gods, the top, the creator, the one true God, And he's the possessor of heaven and earth, that he owns it all. Some translations say creator of heaven and earth. But notice in verse 20 that Melchizedek gives glory to God for this victory. Even though Abram behaved wisely in how he handled the victory itself was God. God did that. But it's interesting, as Melchizedek blesses Abram, this ties right into Genesis 12, verse 3, where God said, I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So this Melchizedek is a guy who blesses Abram, and who, I must assume, was blessed himself for doing so. Melchizedek acknowledged that God Most High was the one who had given Abram the victory, and he pronounces a blessing upon him. Now, when we read Abram's response to this blessing at the end of verse 20, it's really interesting. And if you go on your own and you read what the writer to the Hebrews has to say about that, it's fascinating. But what happens is Abram gives him a tithe of all. So this is the first time we hear about a tithe. Abram gives a tithe or a tenth of all that he has on him. He gives a tenth of this to Melchizedek. By him doing that, what Abram is acknowledging is that Melchizedek was his superior. You know, it's the superior who blesses the inferior, and it's the inferior who tithes to the superior. And that's what's going on here. And so I believe that Melchizedek is a type of Christ, and that this makes total sense. Melchizedek foreshadows Christ and how that Christ blesses us, and we're to give to him. He's our superior. So interesting things. Again, study more in Hebrews and kind of work this thing out if you're interested. Now we shift from the king of Salem back to the king of Sodom as we move into verse 21. Now the king of Sodom said to Abram, give me the persons and take the goods yourself. So the king of Sodom here now comes on the scene and he's making a deal with Abram. He says, I just want my people back. I want the citizens of my city back. You can take all of the stuff. So Abram has a choice to make. Verse 22. But Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have raised my hand to the Lord, God Most High, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will take nothing from a thread to a sandal strap, and that I will take nothing that is yours, lest you should say, I have made Abram rich. It's interesting. Abram's response. You know, the king of Sodom is basically saying, hey, why don't you have a reward for what you've done? You've done this thing at personal cost. Why don't you do it? But he says, no, I've raised my hand to the Lord. In other words, I've sworn to the Lord. And it's interesting here, too, that Abram picks up the same language that Melchizedek just used. He says, hey, the God Most High, the possessor of heaven and earth, he says, I'm not going to take anything from you. Why? Because I don't want you to take credit for making me rich. I don't want you to get the credit. See, what was going to happen is if Abram began to take the riches of an ungodly city, that would begin to taint his name. And they begin to say to Abram, well, you know, Abram's really rich, but have you seen the deals he's making? It's kind of shady. You see how he's got a guy on the construction board, and they're kind of letting some things slide. But, you know, he's making shady deals. And so he doesn't want to do that. And also, I believe that Abram's a wise man. He's an older man by this time. He's been around the block. And he knows that if you take money from an unscrupulous character, there are strings attached. Hey, why don't you take all this stuff? And you'll owe me. There'll be a favor forthcoming. And so he doesn't want any ties with the king of Sodom. How different can Abram and Lot be? Lot can't wait to go back to the city. But Abram says, no, I'm not going to take anything from you. I want to have a strict division. So verse 24, he says, the only thing I'll take is what the young men have eaten and the portion of the men who went with me. Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre, let them take their portion. So he's basically saying, I don't want anything personally. The guys have eaten some stuff along the way. Can you just let that go? And, you know, if you want to reward the guys who helped, you know, these Amorites, you can do that. But me personally, I'm not going to take anything from you. And I think that's a really wise, wise move. So we're going to stop here for today and pick up in Genesis 15 next Sunday, Lord willing. But I just want to close with a final application question. Kind of the one big point. As I was moving through this passage, and there's a lot of history and kind of just information, I was struggling at first with, like, what's that big point? But really what I believe it is, it's that, what is it in our lives? What is it that we need to say, don't come around here no more to ourselves? what is that thing that we're toying with, that we're playing with, that we're pitching our tent near, that we're dwelling in, that is just going to come back to bite us? What is that thing? You see, I look at Lot, and Lot is a tragic character. He's one of those individuals that you see all along the way he had these opportunities to do something different, an opportunity to repent, an opportunity to change. But he didn't take care of that opportunity. He didn't take advantage of that. So I'd encourage you today, if there's something in your life, and maybe it's a small seed now, but you need to say to yourself, you know, I can't go around that anymore. I need to break. I would encourage you today to make that break with it. I would encourage you today to let that thing go, to repent while there's still time to get right.